Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to the Seeking Justice Show on Blog Talk Radio. My name is Denny Griffin, and tonight my co-host Kim Colt and I will be with you for the next hour. Kim, good evening.
Good evening, Denny. It's so nice to be here tonight with you.
Well, nice to be back with you. We've been a little spotty in our programming here over the last few weeks, but
yes.
This is our final show, by the way, for 2009, and I think it's a good show to complete our year with.
Mm-hmm.
And tonight we're going to be talking, I don't want to say it, let me put it this way, somewhat uplifting story of justice. And we're going to be discussing a double homicide that took place in Illinois, McHenry County, Illinois, back in 1981. And on that night of June 2nd, the morning of June 2nd, two people were found shot to death in the living room of an apartment at the rear of the PM Pub, located at 238 West Rand Road in Lakemore, Illinois. The victims were the tavern's owner, 37-year-old Ronald Scharf, and barmaid Patricia Freeman, who had worked her shift at the bar the previous evening. For 27 years, the murders remained unsolved. And then in 2008, Paul Scharf, Ron's son, received a phone call that his former babysitter had read a book that she believed included a segment on the Scharf and Freeman killings. The investigation was reactivated, and a little over a year after receiving that call, the Scharf and Freeman families obtained a degree of closure. And tonight we have with us to discuss this case, we have Paul Scharf, Ronald Scharf's son. Paul, welcome.
Hi, Denny. How are you?
Very good. Thanks, Paul. Thanks for being with us. And we also have Paula Freeman, Patricia Freeman's daughter. Paula, welcome to Seeking Justice.
Thank you, Denny. I'm glad to be here.
Now, the circumstances, I'll go into just a little bit, and then I'll involve Paul and Paula. But right after the murders, the police were given information that a suspect that they might want to look at was a gentleman named, I use that term loosely, a man named Lawrence Newman. And he was a Chicago area guy, originally from St. Louis, living then in McHenry County. And his ex-wife had some allegedly an altercation with Ronald Scharf, and she had got a hold of her former husband, Larry Newman, and told him that she felt she had been insulted or what have you, or treated wrong by Mr. Scharf at the bar. And Newman, according to witnesses, was very upset about this and felt that he wanted to exact some type of revenge. So the police had this information early on, and what happened to it is really unclear. And the following year, the police received an additional source of information also, in fact, not just saying that Newman may have been involved, saying that Newman was, in fact, the killer, and that he had admitted it. And this came from a former mobster who was living in Las Vegas at the time named Frank Collada. And Collada said that he had been present in a restaurant when Newman received a call from his ex-wife complaining about the incident at the tavern, and that Newman told him that he would have no choice because he had been disrespected. The treatment of his wife, according to him, was a sign of disrespect toward him, and that he had to go back to the tavern and seek revenge. And that information, and afterward, when he got back to Vegas from McHenry County, he told Frank that he had in fact killed both people. That information in 1982, when Mr. Collada became a government witness, was relayed to the McHenry County authorities. They went to the prison where Mr. Collada was being held and interviewed him and returned then to McHenry County. And even after that, nothing happened regarding Mr. Newman. And then these cases then were cold cases for all this time. Paul, have I got it pretty well accurate so far?
I believe you do.
Okay. And then, Paul, would you tell us what happened when you heard from Holly Hager, who she is, and when you heard from her and what the conversation was like a couple of years ago?
Sure. Well, I didn't hear from Holly at first. I heard from her father. Her father was Jim Hager, and he was also my dad's best friend, and he was also the first person back in 1981 to tell McHenry County that they want to take a look at Larry Newman because of that altercation that you were talking about. But it all began with Jim and Holly taking a car ride back to where Jim currently living in Arkansas. And on the way in the car ride, Holly brought up the murder of my father and Patricia Freeman. Holly was also my former babysitter. And so she was asking her dad about who he thought might have done it. And he mentioned two names, and one of the names were Larry Newman. So what she did was she started to go ahead and Google the name Larry Newman when she got back home. In doing so, she was able to find out some information. She was able to find out about a book, Collada, and in that book, she read an excerpt of what sounded like my father and Patricia Freeman's murder. So Holly sent the information to Jim and basically asked Jim to look at it and say, tell me why this guy isn't the man that murdered them. And so after Jim looked at the book and what else they had out on Google, he called me, and he told me that he knew who killed my father, that it was written in a book, and the book was Collada. And so as soon as I got off the phone with Jim, I couldn't find the book around here in Dallas anywhere. But I ordered it online. I read it, the excerpt on Amazon.com online, and I really did feel like Jim and Holly that this really was my father and Patricia Freeman that they were talking about. So eventually I called the PR group of the publisher of the book, Collada, and then eventually I got a hold of you, Denny. And then we started to raise questions and raise awareness of this issue until we could drive it to a conclusion, which we did this year, where the McHenry County Sheriff named Larry Newman as the killer of my father and Patricia Freeman as under an exceptional status, which an exceptional status is reserved for a person that cannot be extradited, or a person that is already serving life in prison, or in our case, has already passed or is deceased. So that was the best that we could hope for as far as naming Larry Newman as the murderer, and that's what we got.
Thanks, Paul. And Paula, now, this was your mom's death was a cold case for so many years. When did you hear about the Collada book and so on and so forth, and that there might be some more activity going on in the investigation?
Actually, it was probably about almost about a year ago that I heard about it. I got in contact with Paul, and he started telling me about what was going on, and that was when I did my first radio show with you guys. So it's been about a year. It's been, you know, the emotions have been up and down, but, you know, it's going okay now.
Paula, what were your thoughts when you got the news? Did you expect anything would happen, or do you think it was just kind of a, you know, because the information had been out in McHenry's possession for all these years, did you expect they would actually do anything, or were just paying lip service to it?
Well, you know, I'm sorry.
Well, that question's for both of you, I guess. Paula, why don't you go first, and we'll have Paul answer.
Okay. I was hopeful about it, but I wasn't, you know, getting my hopes up too much, because I know back when the murders happened, they did have all the information. They just really didn't do anything with it. So.
Yeah, and I would say for me, probably somewhat similar. You know, I looked at it from a moral perspective, and apparently everything was very obvious to me what was going on. But what would happen with that information, I had no idea. I just understood that I was going to have to go to work.
Mm-hmm.
Kim, do you have any questions for Paul or Paula at this point?
Well, I do. Did they ever find any sort of forensics? Did the investigators, were they able to find any sort of forensics obtained from inside the PM pub? Was there anything that they had to go on in the beginning? Because if Jim Hager had called and said, I think you should look at Larry Newman, but yet the investigators seemed to be focusing on Patricia Freeman's boyfriend, I think, or mm-hmm. an ex-boyfriend. Was there anything at the scene? Do we know of any forensics that they may have recovered?
From what I understand, and Kim, I didn't get a chance to really get into the investigation itself and the pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But from what I understand and what I recall from way back when, there was a couple drinking glasses in a bar, not so exceptional, but the bar was closed. All the glasses were cleaned except for these two glasses. So I don't know if any conclusions were drawn from those glasses. I know at one point in the recent investigation that they did get a sample of DNA from Larry Newman from the prison, and they were going to try to match it up to some things that they had at the crime scene. I don't know if they actually did or not.
Okay, that's what I was wondering about. The other question I had was there were some specific details that Frank provided back in 82. Obviously, he told the investigators back in 82. And there, but now fast forward to, what was it, 2000, oh gosh,
2008.
I don't have it right, 2008, he was, let me see if I can find it here. Anyway, he was, they said that that those were very important, that was very important information, and it was only known, either you'd have to be present or told by the killer this information. Now, it was these the same things that Frank told the investigators at the get-go in 82? I mean, I just wonder why they didn't link it back in 82, why the investigators didn't think, wow, now that's something only the killer would know or someone present would know. See what I'm going with that?
Yeah. You know, I mean, here's the thing. There was so much information. You have to understand that Jim Hager and Frank Colata never knew each other, never met, didn't know each other from Adam. And they were talking about the exact same situation. And if you could hear those two talk about the situation, they're half a country apart, but it's seamless. And there was so much information that was pushed up into the McHenry County Sheriff's lap that you can only draw a couple conclusions, that they were either arrogant, derelict, or on the take. You know, I will leave that up to people to kind of decide what they think. But I've spoken to very credible people, both on the mobster side and on the law enforcement side, that will say that back then McHenry County was definitely in the pocket of the Chicago outfit.
Okay. Well, that makes sense.
And all these people we're talking about are an extension of the Chicago outfit. So,
mm-hmm.
I can interject here. I talked to Frank, just for anybody who doesn't know, Frank and I co-authored his biography in 2007, and that was the book that Holly Hager had read when she saw the information she felt was related to the Sharp and Freeman killings. And I talked with Frank at length, and basically Paul just summed it up pretty nicely, that Frank felt the reason nothing was done at the time was because of the outfit's influence in McHenry County. And he felt that once he turned and became a government witness, it was even more important for them to ignore him, for the authorities to ignore him, because Frank was going to be testifying against a lot of the outfit big shots. And for McHenry County to have brought him in and given him credibility as a witness would be counterproductive to the interests of the outfit bosses. They didn't want Frank to have any credibility. They didn't want to put him in the limelight and say, hey, you know, thanks to this guy's testimony, we're getting a we're charging and perhaps got a conviction against Newman. So that's Frank's opinion of how that came down and why. And it seems from everyone I've talked to about it to be, you know, make quite a bit of sense, actually.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
I would have to agree.
Paul, now, you were contacted then or contacted McHenry after this new information. Well, not really new information, but the information resurfaced. And what happened? You were contacted by them, and what did they tell you, McHenry County, after the information became available again?
Well, you know, I never contacted them. And my reason for it is I didn't trust them. You know, I didn't know what was going on, and I was still trying to piece a lot of this stuff together for myself, and I didn't know who to go to. What actually happened was Holly shared this stuff with her sisters, and her sister Heidi actually called McHenry County Sheriff and, you know, and asked about my father's case. And that's when they got involved into it. They actually went and got the book, and they felt after reading the book that there was something here. So they opened up their investigation.
Paula, do you recall, now you were a young girl at the time of in 81 when all this took place, when the killings took place, do you have any recollection, or maybe you've heard from other family members or something, about the police investigation at that time? Was your impression, if you have one, of how thorough they were back in 81? Did you get any feedback on that, or do you remember anything personally about it?
You know, my family kept me pretty much secluded from it. I was only 8 years old at the time, so they didn't want me to know too much of what was going on. But as I got older, you know, I was told so many different things, I didn't know what to believe. So as far as the police go, all I know is that, you know, most of the family members had the same consensus that there was something that they, you know, they didn't want other people to know. They were keeping things hidden from people. They weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing the appropriate way.
I was remiss here at the start. I forgot to give out our phone number. If anybody has a question or comment for Paul or Paula, you can reach us at 646-478-0982, 646-478-0982. Paul, regarding the investigation back in 81 and 82, as my recollection is that when you started checking into this over the past several months, that the officer at the time who was handling the investigation worked a little bit funny. He didn't really seem to have any partners. He was like a kind of a lone ranger or something, and didn't keep records and didn't keep files. Am I correct on that?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is comments made from the McHenry County Sheriff Department's current administration, that they found like there was no centralization of the information about the case, and that who we're talking about, who's Detective Hendel, who later became Sheriff Hendel, but at the time Detective Hendel was the lead investigator. And what he would do with his investigative officers was give them a slim piece of what it is that they needed to focus in on, and they would have absolutely no comprehension to the value of what they were doing in the big picture of things. So there was only really one person that knew what was going on with this investigation, or at least that's what I can surmise from the comments made by the McHenry County Sheriff's Department.
And Mr. Hendel is now deceased, right?
He is.
Okay. And let me get back to Mr. Newman for a moment. Larry Newman, and this is something that puzzled me greatly when Frank and I were writing his biography. And at the time it was written, I clearly remembered the McHenry County incident that we put in the book. But I didn't realize at the time these were cold cases. I thought they had been solved some way or other, and I wasn't aware of what was going on. I knew Newman was doing life in prison for murder at that time. What I wasn't clear on that Paul Scharf and Patricia Freeman were not part of his life sentence. That was a separate murder that he was doing life on. And when I was researching a little bit about Newman, Frank met him in prison in Illinois, Stateville Prison. And Newman was doing, at that time, 12-year sentence for a triple homicide. He killed three people after an incident in a Chicago bar. He killed two people inside the bar, two employees, and then as he was leaving, and this was with a shotgun, when he left the bar, he ran into or bumped into a newspaper, a young man who was delivering newspapers, delivering the newspapers to the newsstands. It wasn't a kid, but it was a young fellow who was distributing newspapers early in the morning to the newsstands on the Chicago streets. And he just happened to be in the area of the bar dropping the papers off when Newman walked out of the saloon after killing the two people inside. And the guy was just in the wrong place at the wrong time, so Newman shot and killed him also. And so here's a guy doing doing life for 100 and some years, virtually life. And somehow, after serving only 16 years, he got out on parole. Now that just boggles my mind that he was on the streets. A very weird thing. I don't know. I've never lived in Illinois or anything, but does that seem odd? Am I the only one that thinks that's odd that a triple murderer was out to kill again? Paula, what do you think about Newman being loose to kill your mother?
I can't even fathom it. You know, if you kill three people, you should be in prison for the rest of your life. You shouldn't be released on parole. I don't, you know, he should have been put in the gas chamber then, you know, so he didn't have the chance to kill my mom.
Yeah, and I was told, now I don't know if this makes sense or if you or Paul would know, but I was told that Newman's father was a successful furniture manufacturer, salesman or something from St. Louis. And in fact, Newman, Larry Newman, had a trust fund. He was getting a fairly decent, now remember, we're back in the 70s and 80s now, and he was getting a pretty good chunk of money every year from this fund. And he was one of these criminals who didn't have to be a criminal. He wasn't starving to death. He wasn't from some split family and all that kind of stuff that you generally hear about somebody having to take to a life of crime because they couldn't get a job and all that kind of thing. He was he stole and killed because he liked it, as near as anybody can figure. And I guess it just shows you what type of individual this guy was. And I say he was because it turned out he died in prison in 2007 while he was serving, this time, a life sentence without parole. But but that first time, to not get away with, but only serve 16 years for a triple homicide, I still find stunning every time I think about it. Paul, what are your thoughts on Newman getting out and back from that first sentence?
Well, I'm from Illinois, and I'm not shocked, unfortunately. I should be, but I'm not. Illinois is definitely known for its corruption in government and its legal system. You alluded to Larry's father, who was well off, and I want to say sporting equipment. He was a salesman in sporting equipment. And I know when I talked to Frank told me that Larry Newman, this is back in the 70s, would get $10,000 every 2 months. So that's $60,000 a year back in the 70s, which would probably equate to about $130,000, $140,000 a year nowadays. And that's kind of what I kind of surmised from this, is that there was probably some kind of backdoor dealings with probably some money involved and maybe other influences that was able to get Larry Newman out. And I think that's what happened. And for the sake of a few to get greased or whatever happened, more people died because of it, because they let this man out. And it's awful. It's awful. It changed my life, that decision.
Changed a bunch of lives, and it's...
It sure did.
Kim, what do you think about this? Are you... I know you don't live in Illinois, but are you surprised that Newman would have been back on the streets to additional murder?
Well, yes, I would think so. Now, didn't those murders take place back in the 50s?
56.
Correct.
Okay, yeah, I was thinking 56 or 57. So it's hard. I really don't know what was the norm back there to spend 16 years of a life sentence and then get out, but it certainly was the wrong person to let out. Those mistakes happen today. But and Paul, I think you're right. It's just a matter of the amount of corruption within the system, and it sure sounds like it certainly was very corrupt. And what are you going to do about that? You know, and Larry was just a part of it. I was very surprised to hear that he was so well off. This is the first time I'm hearing that, and I'm very shocked. I didn't realize that he was as well off as he was, and that he came from what sounds like a good family. And I guess he just was a sociopath. I don't know. That's very strange to me. And it did change your life, and it changed Paula's. Obviously, she was 8 years old. And Paul, you were very young. How old were you?
I was
12.
And on the incident on the day that they were killed, and then my father's wake was 3 days later, which was also my birthday, so 10, 11.
Wow. That's not a good time. Oh, it's never a good time to lose a parent, but such an integral part of your life right there. Obviously, both you and Paula, you too, you went through a grief process with this, and then you fast forward to 2006, and it's kind of dredged up again in a way. Did you feel that you kind of had to go through some sort of grieving process again, or did you have that sense of grief all over again, or perhaps this was your sense of closure? Paul, go ahead first.
For me, I was too young at the time to really let it sink into what actually happened. I knew I grew up without a mother, but when it was brought back up, I didn't relive it again. It happened to me then.
Okay.
It was hard.
Wow, you had to go through all that as if it was happening at that time. Oh.
Yeah, it was difficult.
That's devastating.
I had good friends and good family. Paul was the main one.
Cool. And Paul, how did you feel? A sense of closure on it? Like, oh, finally, somebody is coming to justice for this. Even though that's not exactly how it worked out, but, you know, finally we know what happened, I guess. Did you feel that way?
I kind of felt that way after finding the book. You know, now what are we going to do about it?
Oh, that's true, yeah.
And for myself, it really became, you know, one, to honor my father, to honor Patricia. And I know that there was a lot of people out there stuck on that day. And people had to get past that day. And I was going to drive this to the best conclusion that I possibly could to kind of help with that. For myself, when it actually happened back in 81, I grieved through my own eyes, meaning I really saw how this stuff was reflecting me, and everything that was going on came back to me. Going through this again, I was looking at it from how did this affect others? And what I come to realize that I didn't back then was really the tidal wave that it caused, impacting a lot more people's lives than I initially thought. You know, I really looked at it as like an immediate family problem, and it certainly wasn't that. It was a community issue, and the community suffered, and I understood that a lot better talking to people.
I'm watching the chat room here, and there's been some comments about Newman and his character and so forth, and people being cruel and evil. I think it probably is worth me mentioning this to give a little even more insight into Larry Newman. If anybody saw the 1995 movie Casino, with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci and Sharon Stone, the Vegas-based movie, Pesci's character was based on a Chicago outfit enforcer named Tony Spilotro. And Newman, at the time, the 80-81 era, was working as part of a crew in Vegas that was under Tony Spilotro's control. Tony Spilotro was a very violent individual in his own right. And a lot of the scenes that were portrayed in the movie with the guy's head in a vise and Spilotro turning, or Pesci in the movie, turning the handle in the vise till the guy's eye popped out, those things were based on facts. Spilotro feared Larry Newman, which says something for Newman's reputation. Tony told Frank Collado one day, he said, "Whatever you do, Frankie, don't ever unleash that bastard on me." Another
cops
thing
were afraid of him, too.
Yeah?
Cops were afraid of him.
Oh, sure.
Everybody was afraid of him.
And in 1979, there was a government witness in Las Vegas that had to be hit. And they were, Frank and Tony Spilotro were planning the killing and deciding who would go on the job. Frank was going to go, but he had to have a driver and backup type person with him. And Larry Newman wanted the job because Newman knew the individual who was going to be hit. And he also knew this man's wife, who was not involved in organized crime activities. And Newman said, "I not only want to go on the killing, I want her there too," because he said, "I want to kill her and cut her up in little pieces." And nobody really knows why he had this hatred for this woman. But he was so vicious that they would not allow him to go on the hit. They brought in another guy from Chicago to accompany Frank on the killing because they were afraid of what Newman would do. And they did it. The actual killing took place when this individual's wife was working. So she was not harmed. She was not home at the time. But I think that further illustrates how Newman thought. He was just a very, very, very a disturbed individual, I'll put it mildly.
Did he?
But also very smart, though. Very smart. Very high IQ.
Calculating.
Wow.
Very calculating. Very dangerous person.
Did he have children?
Not that I'm aware of.
Wow.
Another tad of interesting stuff, that when Newman finally was sentenced for life without parole, and that's what had him in behind bars when he died, came about as a result of Frank Collado, after Frank became a government witness. What happened was, after Frank was paroled from prison, Newman was still in, serving this 112 or whatever year sentence. Then he got the miracle parole, and he told Frank, Frank had moved to Las Vegas to join Tony Spilotro. But Newman gets a hold of Frank and he says, you know, if you got any hot scores in Chicago, any good where we can make a few bucks, let me know. Another guy and I will go along, do them, and then we'll kick some money into you. We'll pay you for the information, for the tip, and so forth. So Frank gets information on a potentially pretty big robbery of a jeweler, and his name was Brown. Last name was Brown. And he calls Newman and says, hey, you wanted, you know, some action. He says, here's a good score for you. He said, you should be able to make, you know, six figures at least. So Newman and another fellow go and they to rob the jeweler. So Frank is kind of waiting to hear when he's going to get his cut, you know, how much they made and what his cut was going to be. And Newman actually shows up on Frank's doorstep in Vegas. And he's got a briefcase or a satchel with money in it. And he tells Frank, he said everything went smooth. And he says, Newman says, well, not really. Frank says, well, what happened? He says, well, we had to change the plan a little bit. Frank says, how do you mean? He says, I killed him. Frank says, what? You killed the jeweler? He said, yeah. He said, I got in there, he says, and the more I got thinking about it, he says, I was afraid he might identify one of us, or, you know, this guy apparently had mob connections himself, this jeweler, and he might sick somebody else on us from another crime family. So he said, the more I looked at him, I could see him as causing us a lot of grief, and I figured the best way was to get rid of him. So he took a machete that was hanging on a wall as some kind of an ornament, and they did the guy. And that's what Frank's testimony about Newman's admission and, you know, was what got him the life without parole sentence. But, you know, again, another case. So he killed six people that we know of that yeah. he was convicted for or
he's
named
convicted of.
As the killer of.
Yeah, the ones that we know of.
Yeah. And who knows how many. And he wanted to kill a bunch more.
Mm-hmm. It didn't seem to get, you know, be much to get him to act out. Somebody in the chat room is asking, were his murders more pre-calculated or more so acts of rage? Gosh, I don't know.
I would draw the conclusion that they were calculated. I mean, he'd be in a rage, but he would calculate what he was going to do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it certainly was.
Everything that we know of that he's been convicted of, they were all calculated. They were all planned.
Well, he seems like he would have been a real liability for the mob. I think that they would have wanted to get rid of him. He was just this out of control.
Well, it got to that point. You know what? My father and Patricia were killed on June 2nd, 1981. The Hole in the Wall gang, and that was Frank's crew along with Larry Newman in that crew, got busted in Big Bertha's robbery on the 4th of July that year. So there was only a month or so lapse time. But Frank did have a conversation with Larry saying, hey, you know what? He goes, it's the little man, and he was referring to Tony Spilotro. The little man finds out about this, you're going to get killed. You know, and he's referring to the murder of my father and Patricia Freeman.
Mm-hmm.
And Frank told me, he goes, you know who's going to have to do it? He goes, it's going to be me. You know, so you better hope that little man never finds out about this.
Oh, well, is that the little man? Okay.
So they wound up into a whole bunch of different problems, not even 30 days later.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of funny, the 4th of July was also my father's birthday. So, a little sense of justice on that aspect. But that was the case that Frank later became government witness because of that robbery.
Mm-hmm. Wow. How was your mom? Is she still with you to be able to see the closure on this?
Yeah, she was.
Oh, good.
Kind of used myself as a conduit of things. She didn't want to be talking to people and reliving all this stuff. But she supported me in the things that I was trying to do to get this resolved.
Okay.
We had a question in the chat room, Paul. What are your thoughts about Frank Collada today? How do you feel about him?
You can make a lot of judgments to Frank about Frank. But Frank, for me, is the guy that tried to stop Larry Newman from killing my father, because what we didn't talk about was when Larry's ex-wife called Larry in Las Vegas, that phone call came into Frank's pizza parlor. And so Frank was there when Larry got that phone call. And Larry just went into a complete rage. And Frank tried to talk him out of it, and he actually thought that he did talk him out of it. And back in 1981, he told the story because he had to. He had a deal with law enforcement that said if he was caught in a lie or was caught holding back information, that he would go to prison for the rest of his life. If he would have got stuck in prison, the outfit would have got him. It would have been a death sentence. But for him to talk again back in 2008 and 2009, and the McHenry County Sheriff relied on him very much so in coming to the conclusions that they did, he didn't have to do all that. And you have to also understand that every time that Frank says something, they can always go back to that deal and fact check it. And if he's misunderstood, or if they determine that something he says and they want to call it a lie, he's going to prison, even to this day. Frank put his neck out for my family and the Freeman family, I feel. So I have high regards for Frank Collada.
Yeah, he's went, I think in this case, Paul, I agree with you, he went kind of the extra mile. He had complied with law enforcement, which is what, like you say, he had to do. But he didn't have to become involved with the second phase of this.
His involvement in this past investigation, I'll just characterize it as steep. He really went out of his way.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll just leave it at that characterization.
Now, if regarding the case here against Newman, or the most recent investigation that resulted in Newman being named as the killer of Ron and Patricia, you still would have liked to have seen some other things. Am I right, Paul? I mean, this was
absolutely
great. A certain amount of closure, but it didn't answer all the questions. Mm-hmm. And why don't you go ahead and explain what it is you would have wanted if you, in a perfect world, what else would have happened?
Sure. This was a little bit of a conspiracy, my opinion.
Absolutely.
When Debbie called Larry, she didn't call, for him to send her flowers to make her feel better. She knew exactly what she was doing and who she was calling. This was her ex-husband. She knew what he was all about. And unfortunately, through this investigation, she wasn't named or convicted of anything or charged with anything, and she really should have been. She got away with murder, in my opinion. So that's one sore spot with me. Two, no explanation whatsoever of what happened back in 1981 and 1982, why justice was what seems to me chosen to elude us. And I can tell you that things would be different as far as, people's closure, the sense of what happened, and all that, if this was handled correctly. You know, we find this stuff out for, you know, almost 30 years later. What was happening at the time is that this community, this small community in McHenry, was scared to death. They didn't know what was among them. We had no understanding, no explanations, plenty of rumors, but our fear was never quelled of what was out there. And not to mention, you know, this definitely interfered with the transition of people becoming, you know, victims to survivors. Because this wasn't handled, there's still victims out there, and that's a shame. And that doesn't seem like that's going to change. But that's what happens when justice is eluded.
There's some mention in the chat room about, and you may have already answered this, about how you feel about Newman's wife. You just said that you felt that she got away with murder, or at least was complicit in the killings, that she knew what she was doing when she made that call to Larry.
Not only did she know what she was doing, it seems like she lit the match. She left the match that started the fire.
You know,
very culpable.
You know, myself and Paula, you know, we're missing parents because somebody got intoxicated and somebody didn't feel like they should have been kicked out of
the bunker. Is she still alive?
Yes. Yes, she is.
I wonder how she feels about it today. Maybe she feels differently.
No, she doesn't. No, she doesn't. In fact, she was in a large denial of what her role was, and then she made up some really wild allegations. I don't think remorse is something that she feels or understands.
I see. Well,
Can I ask Paula from let's get a female perspective here. Do you feel any different about the former Mrs. Newman than Paul does, or do you kind of share his opinion?
I personally think she should have been held responsible for it. She's the one that made the call. She knew what she was doing. She knew what type of person her husband was. She knew exactly what she was doing when she made that phone call.
She knew it
was going to get him either hurt or killed.
And she didn't care which, apparently.
Nope.
No. It's like the person who stands up and yells fire in the theater. They need to be prosecuted. There wasn't a fire, but hey, they started this panic. Same with her. She really needed to be prosecuted. Maybe it's not too late. I don't know. Maybe you should go after her for some civil damages. I don't know.
You know, there's something I'm involved in now, unrelated to this, but what this lady did, I just met with her this afternoon, in fact, she suspected that her son was murdered by his soon-to-be ex-wife. And she filed a wrongful death civil suit, something like they did with O.J. Remember when O.J. got acquitted on the criminal prosecution? And she won the civil suit against this girl for her son's death. And Paul, I can't help but mention this. We got one comment in the chat room that says, I think Paul should write his own book about his dad's death and all the years that passed before law enforcement was willing to say who did it. Maybe it's something you and Paula would like to conspire on, given both sides of the, you know, both families.
Maybe.
I have to ask, Paul and Paula, did you know each other, or had you maybe met, or perhaps since this was, you kind of grew up in the same area, had you met prior to this?
No. I mean, I know a lot of Paula's family, but if you're from Lakemore, you know Paula's family, I guarantee.
Yeah.
So I knew a lot of people, some of them, you know, really good friends of our family and stuff like that. So I certainly knew of Paula, but I don't remember as a child us meeting.
Not until after the murder.
Yeah, so.
Okay. Well, interesting. Yeah, like Denny said, you should write a book. the two of you together and how this affected you. I can't. And Paula, you were raised by your father or another relative, or you and your brother? Your brother was a few years older.
Yeah, my brother's 4 years older. We were raised with my father. He did marry soon after my mom passed, but they had been divorced, so it wasn't anything weird. But yeah, she took over, and she did a wonderful job. But yeah, it was hard growing up like that.
Oh sure, yes, and very hard going through the whole, you know, what you experienced in 2007. I can only imagine.
Yeah, it's hard. I didn't know, you know, when I was 8 years old, I really didn't know too much about death. So it didn't really sink in until I was a lot older. You know, I always had pain about it, but I never, until it was brought back up, I didn't actually live through the grief.
And Denny, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Was there a character in that movie Casino that was portraying Larry Newman?
No. Frank Vincent, the character actor, portrayed a character named Frankie, which was Frank Collada. But they didn't have anybody specifically. It showed other gang members and associates, but they didn't have a specific Larry Newman character. And let me just, for those in the chat room, I posted the link to a YouTube video. When McHenry County was informed this most recent time about the Newman connection to the killings, they didn't appear to be doing a great deal. In fact, I thought there was possibly some foot dragging going on. And I did a little interview with Frank and Dennis Arnoldy. Dennis Arnoldy was back in the 80s, was the Las Vegas FBI case agent for the Spilotro investigations for street crimes. And when Frank Collada became a government witness, he was Frank's chief debriefer. And he was the one that coordinated getting McHenry County to send someone to interview Frank about the Sheriff Freeman murders. And so I interviewed both of them and posted it on YouTube. And for anyone interested in that, you can hear Frank and Dennis in their own words telling how this came down in 1982 when Frank rolled. So you may find that interesting. Anyway, the link is posted there if anybody wants to check it.
Okay. Do we still have it in the chat room, Denny? Oh, yeah, there it is, the YouTube link.
Find it?
Yes.
Let me just put it up again just in case so nobody has to scroll for it.
Okay. Yeah, very, very interesting. It was very interesting the way, and actually, you know, the way the cops handled it back in 81 and 82, they really came away with egg on their face. I mean, nothing might not be exactly, I don't think you got any apologies, did you?
No, we didn't get any apologies. And, you know, you have to also think that this is a small town. And information is not nearly as prolific as it is today with the internet and whatnot. And it was a tight-lipped thing. In the Chicago area, when Frank turned and became government witness, it was leaked some of the murders that he knew about. And if you read some of the papers back then from the Chicago Tribune and stuff, the articles read exactly the same as some of the newspaper articles that were done recently if you pull my name and Holly's name out of it. And my mom called Detective Hendel and asked, hey, did we find the killer of my husband? Mm-hmm. And Detective Hendel told her flat out, don't believe what you read in the paper. That's not good information. So it was tight-lipped, and I can tell you from some of the communications that I have that some of that tight-lippedness exists today. There was some people that were leaking words back to me that I needed to drop this. And especially back then, you know, if the fear is still in the environment today, I promise you, it was tight as a drum back then. And the upfront conversation that Sex Handle had with my mom, basically blasting Frank as any kind of credible thing when it happened to be the most credible thing that we had the whole time, speaks a lot of what was going on, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Let me just ask a question. There's been some back and forth in the chat room about Mrs. Newman, or the former Mrs. Newman, and what she may have been drinking that night if she just temporarily lost it. Paul, and I know you, I don't know if Paula has done this so much, but I know you were doing quite a bit of investigation about the Newmans and so forth. My impression is that this wasn't a one-night deal, that she was trouble. I mean, and had a reputation for being trouble. So that this was, in other words, just something that was like some fluke that happened one night. Am I correct that she had the reputation, do you know, as being a problem?
Absolutely. From what I can gather, problem drinker, problem with behaving, problem with the mouth. That you know, she married Larry Newman.
Yeah.
I mean, that says
yeah.
a lot. That says a lot right there. But she was very problematic, and I get the impression that probably had a chip on her shoulder along with all this bad behavior that made her a very dangerous person. And I know, you know, my dad was supposedly friends with Larry Newman. He knew Larry Newman, and he wasn't going to incite anything to cause trouble with Larry Newman unless he had to. And unfortunately, he probably should have kicked her to the curb when she was sober sometime.
Well, I tell you, we're down to our last 3 minutes, and before we say goodnight to everyone, Paul, you had something you wanted to share with us and share with our listeners.
Yeah. Absolutely. You know, I mean, everything seems so apparent and so easy, and I'm going to tell you, it absolutely is not. We went through a lot of work to go ahead and to get Larry Newman named as the killer of my father, Patricia Freeman, and I absolutely did not do this by myself. So I made a short list here. I hope I get everybody, and if I don't, I'm going to say sorry right now. But I want to thank Dennis Arnoldy, former FBI, who was investigating the Chicago outfit back in Las Vegas. He was very critical in the investigation today. He was also Frank Collado's handler at the time when Frank turned government witness, so he had a lot of collaborative information. David Grover, who was a former Las Vegas Metro back in the 80s, taking some affidavits, and was later brought back into this investigation. Carol Marine and Don Mosley from Channel 5 News for doing the stories. The Chicago Sun-Times, the Northwest Herald, the Daily Herald. I want to thank Simon Barrett and Jan Barrett. They would go ahead, and when things started slowing down, they got on the phone with McHenry County Sheriff asking questions, really putting fire back into the investigation. I want to thank Susan Murphy Milano from having me on her show, me and Paula, bringing more awareness to this. I would like to thank Ron Beaver for all his work that he did with our website. We had a website that you can take a look at. It's McHenryCounty1981.com. He did that all on his own time, all on his own dime, and I want to thank him very much for that. I want to thank Lieutenant Sankey, who is the lead investigator for the current investigation and the McHenry County Sheriff's current administration. I want to make sure I stress current administration. I want to, you know, also thank everybody on Facebook, Jury 13, other people that were following the stories. You written letters to key people. You told people that you were interested in the story, and you kept a lot of pressure on that. I want to thank everybody for that. And then I've got some really important people. I definitely want to thank Jim Hager, you know, for being my dad's best friend, for being the guy that when he wasn't around, he was there for me as a kid. And, you know, I want to thank him for coming forward again. And of course, I got to thank Holly Hager. Without her inquisitive mind, inquiring minds want to know, none of this would have happened. So I want to say thank you to Holly, and I love you. Frank Collada. Frank was very critical. And again, I can't go into all the details of what he did, but I can tell you he really went way and above to help out with this investigation. And this wasn't a short investigation. This wasn't a couple months. This went on for over a year, and Frank hung tight with that. And then finally and lastly, I gotta thank you, Denny, for everything that you did. You were the first contact that I made getting this thing going. None of this stuff would have happened without you. And I can say that I put a lot of time in this, and I never once felt like I was doing this by myself. I always had you by my side, and I want to say thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom of my heart.
Well, God, Paul, I'm almost a little wet-eyed here. I'm glad.
Should be. You put yourself out there, Denny.
I'm glad we got done what we got done, and you know, I'm very tickled, and I know we're out of time here. I want to thank you very much, Paula and Paul, for being on with us. I want to thank the people who've listened to us and been active in the chat room. And I want to wish Kim and everyone a very, very Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you, Denny, and Merry Christmas to you and your family. And me too. Paula, thank you so much for coming, and God bless you and your family on this Christmas. And Paul, thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to talk to you, and I want to thank, of course, everybody in our chat room. Good night, God
thank
bless.
You, everybody.
Thank
Don't
you.
Forget
Merry
that
Christmas.
Book, Paul.
Yeah, I'm on it.
Okay, good night, everyone. Merry
Christmas. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.